My name is Stephanie Magin, and I'm on the leadership development team as part of Google EDU. And I manage our program called Managing Your Energy, of which many of you are alumni. Exciting thing is that we have the man behind the content here to talk to us today, so we're really excited. I just wanted to mention, too, as I was kind of running the numbers this morning, over 1,200 Googlers, so over that number of people here, have been exposed to this content. Tony Schwartz, like I said, is kind of like the man behind the, you know, the class that we do here called Managing Your Energy, co-author of the book that spurred that, which was The Power of Full Engagement, Managing Energy, Not Time, so helping us as well as Google to kind of go through that paradigm shift. And he's here to talk to us today about his new book that came out in May and is already a bestseller in New York Times and Wall Street Journal called The Way That We're Working Isn't Working. And he's going to share some kind of new research with us today that gets at a lot of the stuff that we already know, but kind of looking at it in a new way. And we're also going to get to hear from some of the alumni of the class about the changes that you guys have been able to make through exposure to the content. So that's going to be fun. So Tony is the founder and CEO of The Energy Project, which helps individuals and organizations increase their capacity through the science of higher performance. So all of the stuff that we're going to be hearing today is based on science and research, which is great for us data-driven Googlers. So just really quick background on Tony. Started his career as a journalist and had lots of different kind of journalistic and editorial positions working at such publications as the New York Times, Newsweek, the New York and Esquire magazines, and Fast Company. And he also co-authored the number one worldwide best-selling book, The Art of the Deal, which he co-wrote with Donald Trump. So without further ado, let's welcome Tony Schwartz.
Thanks, Stephanie. Hi, Googlers. Good to be here with you. How's everybody doing? Good. All right. So it's. I want to see if this resonates with you. I want you to think about yourself as Johnny in this little story I'm going to tell you, and I want you to tell me if, at the end, it resonates with your own experience in your own life. So it's 7 a.m. somewhere in Mountain View, or wherever you happen to live, and Johnny has just woken up, and he needs to get downstairs for breakfast by 7:15, out the door to school by 7:30. But on this particular morning, he doesn't get downstairs, and his father is downstairs making his breakfast, because he's a modern dad. Mother's already gone off to work. Goes to the bottom of the stairs, yells up to Johnny, "Johnny, your breakfast is getting cold, you're going to be late, hurry on down." Johnny says, "I'm not going to school today." So his father trots up the stairs, he sits down on the foot of Johnny's bed. Johnny's got the covers pulled up all the way to his chin. He says to him, "Johnny, give me three good reasons why you're not going to go to school today." Johnny says, "Fine. Number one, I don't like the kids. Number two, the kids don't like me. And number three, it's too hard." Father says, "Okay, Johnny, now I'm going to give you three good reasons why you are going to school today. Number one, I'm your father, and I'm telling you, you're going to school today. Number two, you're 47 years old. And number three, you're the principal of the school." So this is where we find ourselves, right? You know, those days where you'd rather stay there with the cover, you know, with the cover right up to your chin and not get out of bed. I mean, how many of you would say that in the last 2 or 3 years, the demand in your life has been higher than it's ever been before? How many would say that? Okay, so that's almost the whole room. Over 1,000 people, by the way. How many of you would say, given that these last couple of years have been so intense, and of course with the economy the way it is and all of that, there's some reason why, you know, it's been harder the last couple of years. How many of you would say that you would expect, given all that, things are starting to look a little better now, the bar in the upcoming year will finally be lowered? We got one person, he just lost his job. But everybody else says no. No, here's the $64,000 question. Your demand is going up. You think it will continue to go up. How many of you expect your capacity to meet that demand to rise right along with the demand? So that's not good, right? That's not good. And that's really the absolute core. We really never in human history have had this particular challenge before. And here's the challenge. The challenge is that this is the volume of your demand in the vertical axis here. This is the your age in the horizontal axis. So from early to late, how many of you are getting older? About half. So the demand in your life starts to go up. And sure enough, and the great thing is that almost no matter what you do to yourself and do to your body up until a certain age, your capacity stays out ahead of your demand. But then at a certain moment, it peaks out. And that moment actually physically is about 30 years old. About 30 years old. So actually, rare for my talks in this room, there's some people who are still got the capacity out of the demand. But guess what? That won't last forever. And then what happens is there is a point at which this crosses, and that's a bad moment. That's a bad moment because all kinds of terrible things happen when demand exceeds your capacity. And when I say this has never been the case before in human history, our capacity, given the demands we've had, has always basically been sufficient until the last 10 or 20 or 30 years to meet the demands we're facing. And of course, you know all the reasons why the demand has gone up so high relative to our capacity, because you're responsible for most of them, you know, at Google. Meaning, it's the volume of information now available to us and flooding into our lives. It's the number of ways we can communicate with each other. It's the difficulty of being in a situation where you don't have to communicate. All those things are going on, and they're affecting it. So the problem is that in the face of this rising demand, we don't stop to ask the question, what's the cost? And we have lived since the Industrial Revolution with a certain paradigm about how work should happen in a market economy. And it's that more, bigger, faster is the way to go. But the premise that I operate on, and that I think we're beginning to see progressive leaders and progressive companies begin to embrace, is that more, bigger, faster leads to value that is narrow, shallow, and short-term. Could there be a better example in the world today than BP, right? That was all entirely about more, bigger, faster. What about Toyota? It was about, even they acknowledge, BP may not fully acknowledge this yet, but Toyota acknowledges that more, bigger, faster was the problem. Toyota, Mr. Toyota himself. So this is not a way we can go, and part of the problem is that we don't have the capacity to go more, bigger, faster without all kinds of consequences. And the reason we continue to operate as if we do is that we take capacity for granted. If there's more to do, we'll simply expand our capacity and we'll be able to do it. So when I ask you the question, do you expect your capacity to rise right along with your demand, you're brought up a little short. It's like, what do you mean by that? I'm not quite sure. I never thought about capacity before. I have a lot of skills. I have a lot of talents. What's this thing with capacity? Well, capacity is the fuel in your tank. Capacity is what makes it possible for you to bring your skill and talent to life. So without capacity, no matter how much skill and talent you have, and you have a ton, it's not going to be possible for you to produce it. And the other thing is that though our resources are finite, we treat them as if they're infinite. And I'm talking about our inner resources. This same exact issue exists in the planet, doesn't it? We have made the assumption for a long, long time that it doesn't matter how we spend down the planet's resources because there's plenty more where that came from. Well, those of us who are even half clued in know that's nonsense. And that in a world in which we do not find ways to discover either alternative resources or to renew the existing resources after we use them, we're in all kinds of trouble. The same exact thing is true for us as human beings, personally, internally. So up until now, we've used as the vehicle to meet rising demand, we've used time, right? So when there's more to do, we simply invest more hours. But the problem with that is this. There ain't any more time. You got 168 hours in your week. You're never going to have another hour. And almost everybody in this room has a dance card that's full. Nobody is looking for ways to fill their free time, are they? So that's a problem. That's one of the capacity problems. We have assumed that the way that you can get more done is to put in more hours, but there aren't any more hours. And that's where this other way of looking at the world really evolved for us. And that's because energy can be expanded. Now, look, there, energy can't be expanded, actually, as you know. But energy can be converted from one form to another form. So in practical terms, for you as a human being, you have the potential to bring more energy to the table depending on how you manage and cultivate your energy. And you can regularly renew your energy. Now, here's the thing. Time is outside you. Time is something over which you ultimately have no control. It moves past you like a train moving off into the distance. But energy is inside you. You have the power to influence your own energy. So as soon as you begin to understand what energy really is all about, you're in a whole different kind of situation in terms of being able to take more control of your life. So energy, we define energy, the folks here who teach it at Google define energy in pure, simple physics terms. Energy is the capacity to do work. More energy, more capacity. So the question is, can we get you, can I help you, and can the folks here help you to systematically build the energy available to you? That's really the issue. And there are four kinds of energy. Those of you who've been through the class know that. There are four sources of energy that a human being needs. A car can run on gas, or you know, more recently, a car can run on electricity, but a human being actually needs four. So you need physical energy, quantity. You need emotional energy. That's a particular quality of energy. You need mental energy. That's the focus of your energy. And you need spiritual energy, or the energy of the human spirit, which we define simply as the energy derived from the experience that what you do really matters, wherever you do it. Or the alignment of your energy, meaning that your energy is aimed toward a very conscious goal. So there they are, four sources of energy. If you can recruit all of those and regularly renew them, you're going to fire on all cylinders. But, we don't. Why don't we? Because it takes consciousness to do that. And really, I think what I'm talking about at the profound level is an evolutionary leap in consciousness. I can get away with saying that at Google. An evolutionary leap in consciousness to move toward the kind of intentionality that's now required to meet the demands that we face. So fierce intentionality, I use the word fierce obviously advisedly, because there is so much about our lives that happens habitually and automatically and outside our conscious minds and conscious intention. So to really seize back control of your destiny, you need to apply a kind of intentionality that's never been required of you before. And this is an intentionality. Listen, we have invested enormous energy in the world, and Google is a wonderful and positive example of what happens when you invest energy in understanding and managing better and more efficiently the external world. Wonderful. Look at what you've produced. It's extraordinary. And you have fellow organizations and companies that have also done great, great work about mastering the external world. But we have vastly, vastly undervalued and underinvested in understanding and managing the inner world. And the inner world, let's put aside, you know, whatever new age connotations or psychodynamic connotations that has, the inner world is where these sources of energy are being produced. They're coming from inside you. They're coming from inside you. So to know about them is the first necessity. To understand what's going on effectively inside you is the first critical necessity in being able to change the way you manage it. We have to start to value something that has been invisible to most of us forever. And I like to say that the inner life is our own personal China and India, meaning it's the place where we have the biggest potential for growth, where we ought to be making the biggest investment of our time and energy, because there's so much untapped there. It is terra incognita. It's a vast, that inner landscape is a vast, untrafficked, unmet territory. Bob Keegan at Harvard, who's a wonderful thinker about development, says that we are the most overinformed and underreflective people in the history of the world. That's a scary thing. But the big, the thing that's so profound to me, not only for you, but for organizations, is that the future competitive advantage all lies in your ability to master this inner world. So that could be seen as intimidating, or it could be seen as a wonderful challenge and opportunity. I choose to see it as the latter. So here's from a technological perspective, the way I look at it is that our hardware, our hard wiring, has not changed over the last several hundred years. Nothing's changed. Kids think that their brains operate differently and they can do more things than their parents can do. It's nonsense. Their brains have not changed in that way, or not so substantially. But the demands on our hardware have increased so significantly. And there, it turns out that there is a science and a technology to, that makes it possible. In effect, what there is there's the potential for an upgraded operating system, the ability to use a whole different kind of software to run your own operating system, your internal operating system, than there was even 10, 20, and 30 years ago. Here's why we don't know much about it, among other things. We don't know much about it because it's multidisciplinary, and we live in a world of specialists. And the power of it is that it, the physical dimension affects the emotional dimension, and the mental dimension affects the physical dimension. And all of these are intermingled, but the folks who are expert about any given one of them don't talk to each other. That's the work we've tried to do, is to try to bring together a series of disciplines and the research from those disciplines to make it possible for you to have a life that is not only productive, but is satisfying and sustainable. Now, why is it? Why is it that this isn't working? Well, this is what we think the core understanding and the, what I'm going to spend the rest of my time with you talking about is that we've made an assumption that we should operate in the same way computers do, meaning at high speeds, continuously, for long periods of time, running multiple programs at the same time. But those of you who've been through any part of this work know that that's not the way, and some of you just know it instinctively, that's not the way we're designed. We are designed to be rhythmic beings. We're designed to pulse between expending energy and regularly renewing your energy. And we don't do either one of those very well. Now, that's interesting. It's no surprise to you to think, I don't do so well at renewing my energy, because renewal gets no respect in the world we live in, right? Renewal, rest, recovery, that's for slackers. That's not for Googlers. Googlers spend energy. Slackers renew energy. So that's not so surprising. But it turns out that we don't do very well at spending energy either, meaning we spend tons of it, but we don't spend it in efficient, productive, useful ways, or at least not relative to our potential. So I want to kind of dive in a little bit on both sides of this equation and help you see if you can kind of take a different perspective on the way you're doing each of these two things, renewing energy, spending energy. So let's start with the most important component of renewal. I see a gentleman in the back of the room yawning. That's my cousin. He's doing that for me to lead me to this point, which is I want to sort of try and explode several myths about renewal, because there are so many myths about the role of renewal. And the first one has to do with sleep, because sleep is the single most important renewal activity. and the single most undervalued renewal activity, something we find 100 ways to rationalize not doing enough of. So the myth is, I don't need much sleep. And this wonderful quote from Thomas Roth at the Henry Ford Sleep Disorder Center, the percentage of the population who need less than 5 hours of sleep per night, rounded to a whole number, is zero. So what we know in reality is that actually 97.5% of the population needs at least 7 to 8 hours of sleep. 95% of us need 7 to 8 hours. 2.5% of us need more than 8 hours. And 2.5% of us need less than 8 hours, 7 to 8 hours, okay? So 97.5% of the people sitting in this room today need to sleep a minimum of 7 to 8 hours in order to be fully rested. How many people in this room do not consistently sleep 7 to 8 hours? Okay, so that's about 80% of the room. That's pretty interesting. That's pretty interesting. What's the reality? I'm sorry. What's the rationalization that most of us use? Well, the rationalization most of us use for not sleeping that much is, number one, I don't have time, right? I don't have time. I've got too much to do. And then the related one, which is the myth, is this, is, oops, I guess it's not quite yet. The related one is, if I sleep an hour longer, and this is something you either say to yourself consciously or maybe unconsciously, if I sleep an hour longer, I'll get an extra hour of work done, right? It gives me another hour in my day. I'm sorry, if I sleep one less hour, I'll have it, that was pretty off. If I sleep one less hour, I'll have one more hour that I can do work in, right? Well, that's nonsense. Why? Because when you have insufficient sleep, the costs to you cognitively are extraordinary. I'm going to get to that in just a moment, but here's how important sleep is. And again, some of you may remember this study, but it, to me, is the most powerful study ever done about the importance of sleep, and it was done on rats. So this guy, Alan Rechtschaff at the University of Chicago, probably one of the two or three leading sleep researchers in the world, did this research, this very famous research, in which he deprived these rats of sleep for as long as it took till he got the conclusion he wanted. And what happened is that after, and this is all, every one of these is really interesting. What happened is that after 2 or 3 days, they were expending twice the energy that they would if they had had enough sleep. Now, let's just assume the parallels exist for human beings. Because he took these rats all the way to death, this experience has not been redone with human beings. It's a little bit of an ethical problem to do it with human beings, right? But think about this. In order to stay up, you have to seek an alternative source of energy. So what you do is the system naturally responds by expending more energy. What it means is, whatever energy you're expending when you are sleep deprived is energy not available to do the things you might otherwise do other than trying to stay up. That's interesting. Then the next thing that happens is they overeat. Same reason. They're trying to get some form of energy in the form of glucose. So in order to get that to overcome the absence of sleep, they overeat. And worse yet, the hormone leptin is produced during sleep primarily. And leptin is the thing that tells you that you are satiated when you're eating. And therefore, you lose recognition of the fact that you aren't hungry when you are not sleeping enough. And that's why there's such a powerful correlation between obesity and lack of sleep. And then they lose control of their body temperature. You know how powerful it would be, how devastating it would be if you had a body temperature of 97 degrees or a body temperature of 106. That's not good. And then they begin to develop sores that won't heal. And in 17 to 21 days, these rats are dead. Now, the reality is, as a human being, you would be, though you wouldn't be necessarily, you wouldn't necessarily be dead after seven. In fact, we know that people are not dead. Human beings are not dead after 17 to 21 days of sleep. But you would be completely incapable of functioning after 17 to 21 days. In fact, long, long before that. But the really interesting thing about this study is he goes back and he does the same study, except this time with a different set of rats, poor rats. With a different set of rats, he deprives them of food for 17 days, okay? how the rat's doing at the end of 17 days. What's the one word that best describes how those rats are doing at the end of 17 days? Alive, hungry. I'll take either one. They're fine, but they're hungry. What is the message there? Because if there's one message I could leave you with, if I stopped right now, it would be this one. Sleep is more important than food. That's a big deal. Sleep is more important than food, and yet we don't treat it that way. So when you're depriving yourself of sleep, we think this 1 hour of extra sleep, Okay, good. I just had a panic that slide was as wrong as I had been a moment ago. We have this assumption that 1 hour more of sleep will add 1 hour of productivity to your day, but the reality is that even very small amounts of sleep deprivation profoundly influence not only your physical sense of well-being and your emotional balance, but your cognitive capacity. How many of you have a job here in which you're required to use your brain? Only about two-thirds, which is kind of interesting. That's a kind of important organ here at Google. But here's some of the things that happen if you sleep less than 7 to 8 hours. So Sherry Ma at Stanford, right down the block, Sherry Ma has done all these studies with athletes, and now she's found just recently, some of you may have seen this, that sprinters, when they are asked for a 6-week period to sleep 10 hours or more, turn out to perform dramatically better at their sprints. She's done this across 6, 7, 8 different sports and showed that if you sleep more hours, this sounds crazy to you, 10 hours. When's the last time you slept 10 hours? But it dramatically influences their performance. So you're saying to yourself, well, you know, fine, a sprinter, I mean, they're physically exhausted. Yeah, they need more sleep. Trust me, I'm going to get to another study at the end of my talk today that's going to show you that it's no different, that cognitive capacity, the ability to think, is profoundly influenced, equally influenced by how much you've slept. This is, to me, quite extraordinary, that subjects who were sleeping less than 6 hours a night for 2 weeks, and I'll bet you, how many of you have had a time in your life where you slept less than 6 hours a night for a 2-week period? Right? Isn't that incredible? So look at, that's almost everybody, look at the effect of it, is that it's equivalent to 48 consecutive hours of sleep deprivation. How do you think you'd be functioning at the end of those 48 hours? Now you say to yourself, well, that's nonsense. I mean, come on, I know how I am at the end of these weeks of sleeping less than 6 hours a night. I'm fine. I don't have any problem. And you know what? When they take a guy out of a car on a highway where he's been swerving down the highway, and they put him up and they said, have you had too much to drink? What does that guy usually say? No. Are you intoxicated, sir? No. Does he believe he's intoxicated? No. We don't know the effect that we have. We are in a state of denial about the cumulative impact of insufficient sleep. But these researchers go and actually look at it. So the final one of these statistics I think is pretty interesting is you give the pilot, you got a pilot right here, you give the pilot a 40-minute nap during a long-haul flight, and his vigilance, and by the way, and I was talking to this gentleman who's a pilot here because he's a colleague for me, of mine, I was talking to him on the way out here, and actually the word he used to describe one of the absolute critical skills for a pilot is vigilance. Would you agree with that? We certainly want them to be vigilant when we're in their planes. Their vigilance increases 16% if they have a 40-minute nap during a long-haul flight, and it drops 34% if they don't. They have multiple moments of micro-sleep when they take these long-haul flights without sleep, without a nap, and they have zero instances of micro-sleep when you give them a 40-minute nap. And I should tell you that when you give somebody a 40-minute nap, they only sleep an average of 26 minutes. So in other words, the value of getting, the value you derive from just 26 minutes of a nap is absolutely extraordinary from a performance perspective. And finally, this is really, you know, at the heart of this, this is really the central point here, is that we make an assumption that the best way to get more work done is to work more hours. That's the extrapolation of what I was saying about sleep. If I have twice the amount of work to do, I'll put in more hours. But we're actually much, much more productive when we build in intermittent renewal during the day. This is really the heart of why I'm saying to you that renewal is such a critical component for your life. Not so that you can have, I mean, it's a byproduct that you get a happier life as a result. It's a byproduct that your relationships are better. But from a pure work perspective, it works better to build in intermittent periods of renewal. So recognize this. Every human being must renew and recover. We must do it because our bodies go into periods of fatigue. So if that's the case, what do most of us do to renew? And some of you have seen this, but this is the typical way. I try to keep my coffee buzz going till the martini buzz kicks in. Right? That's the typical way that we use to renew ourselves in the course of the day, along with, by the way, activating unconsciously our stress hormones, because cortisol and adrenaline and noradrenaline prompt a powerful surge of energy that we use in order to stay the course even when we would otherwise or naturally go into periods of fatigue. Here's the most profound cost of using cortisol, adrenaline, and noradrenaline. In the short term, the most profound cost of using those stress hormones to stay the course is that they push us into a state that we know as fight or flight. That's what the nature of pulling those hormones up is. And in fight or flight, the further or the more intensely you get into that state, the more incapable of thinking you are. So we think less well when that happens. So what's the alternative to this? So the alternative is to respect your oscillatory nature. You are meant to move between spending and renewing energy. When you align with that rhythm, you become so much more effective and sustainable. And it's a very specific rhythm. It's a rhythm called the ultradian rhythm that dominates our days. And that you cannot outwit the ultradian rhythm any more than you can outwit the circadian rhythm. The circadian rhythm, you know, is day or night, sleep at night, be awake during the day, mess with that, and the consequences are significant. At night, we sleep in cycles. You know that. There are 5 cycles of sleep. You go from light sleep to deep sleep. And if you sleep through that cycle, you get all the benefits of sleep. And if you do it 4 or 5 times, you get a good night's sleep. During the day, the ultradian rhythm is the analog of that cycle, which is called the basic rest activity cycle. At night, it runs 90 minutes. During the day, it runs 90 minutes. But during the day, it's a waking rhythm. So you move from high physiological arousal, awakeness, awareness, ability to do your work, slowly down into a state of fatigue. And as I've said, we override that rhythm with the stress hormones, coffee, sugar. But if we simply took time to rest and recover at the end of those 90-minute segments, we could naturally refuel the system without cost to ourselves. This is a profound shift. I was talking to Stephanie before about the knowing-doing, paradox. I say this to you. It's well documented by research. It's in my new book, The Research. It's on our website. You hear it, and even though maybe you've never heard of an ultradian rhythm before, it makes sense to you. It certainly makes sense to almost everybody, I suspect, that building in renewal would refuel the system. But we are addicted to the pace that we're living at. In fact, you can literally become addicted to these stress hormones, to adrenaline and cortisol and noradrenaline. They are the addiction of immediate gratification. It's like cocaine, I mean, it's a buzz. So the question then is, if 90 minutes is the frequency with which you should take a renewal break, especially if you're working hard, how long should the break be? How long do you think the break should be? How long? I wish I was talking into this. It's so much better. But it keeps dropping. 10 minutes. Yeah. What else? As long as it takes. Now, that's from one of the people who teaches the work, so I'm going to assume that's true. It's not about how long you renew. It's about how well you renew. It's not about how many hours you invest in work during the day. It's about how well you can work during the hours you work. So here's what's interesting. Again, back to the science that undergirds this. The myth is that fitness is a measure of how long you can expend your energy, right? So you think of somebody who's training aerobically, and that you assume that the person who can go 2 or 3 hours is the person who is fitter than the person who can go 1 hour. But actually, the definition of fitness is the speed of your recovery. So the fitter you are, the faster you recover. Meaning that instead of training ourselves to be able to expend more energy more continuously, which is the way we live our lives, even if we don't always do it in fitness, we do it in general, you want to train yourself to recover more quickly. Right? So the only way you can do that is if you value recovery, if you value renewal. Now, so this is how we get more fit, and it's not just at the physical level. Any muscle that you train by pushing it past the comfort zone and then renewing will get stronger. If you push past the comfort zone for too long and you don't renew, you'll break down the muscle. So this is obviously true in weight training. It's also true in cardiovascular training, but it's also true emotionally. It's true that the way that you get more emotionally resilient is you put yourselves in a position of demand on you emotionally, and then you recover. And the more quickly you can recover, the more resilient you are. The more you put yourself to the test, and then succeed at recovering without lashing out, for example, the more resilient you become. So what that requires is that you be able to recover quickly. And what that turns out to lead to is an amazing quickness with which you can recover. So in this, what I call the time between points, my former partner, who was a sports psychologist named Jim Lehrer, did this work with athletes, with tennis players, in which he watched them from the side of the court trying to understand what separated the great players from the near great players. And he could not see any difference between them in the way they hit the ball. It wasn't until he started noticing how they spent the time between points that he saw that was where the difference occurred. And the reason he saw it is because one day he had number one in the world and number two in the world, this is going back 25 years, on either side of the court, and he noticed that each of them was doing the same set of sequenced activities between points, and when he watched lesser players, they weren't doing any of it. And that set of sequenced activities were all designed to build quick recovery. I'll give you just one example. One was when the point ended, they turned away from the net. The reason they turned away from the net, and by the way, nobody had taught them this, this was natural selection. This is the difference between the great and the near great. The great figure it out. The reason they did that is because they needed to let go. They needed to stop spending energy where it was no longer useful. How much of your energy do you spend today on things that you can no longer influence, in regret or frustration? It's not just building back energy that's important in your life. It's not just refueling energy. It's not squandering energy on things that don't have any impact, that you can't have an impact on. So that's the renewal side of the equation. Now, I want to switch to the energy expenditure side of the equation for the rest of the time we have together. So I've tried to make the case here that renewal really matters, that it's best done in 90-minute increments, that the more you train it, the better you get at it, and the faster you recover, and that this oscillatory nature is something given to us, it's in our hardwiring, and we can either fight it to our detriment, or we can align with it and change our lives. And I say that because it's profoundly changed my own life, and because I've watched it profoundly change other people's lives. As a matter of fact, who in here has used some of this technology from having gone through the classes to build more renewal into your lives? Is there anybody in the so tell me, say to the group what you've done and what you think the impact has been. Yeah, and what's the impact on your work? Because the assumption would be, if what he said is, when he leaves here at night, work is over, and he no longer stays the course. You know, he's not checking his BlackBerry and, you know, plugging in and making phone calls. So the assumption would be that you would be less productive because you're probably working fewer hours total since you're not now checking. What's happened? And so he said he's fresher when he's here. Does that mean when you're actually working, you're more productive? So he said he's more productive. Again, this is my other cousin, and I brought him here to do that testimonial. No. So anybody else who's had a renewal, use this renewal understanding to their benefit? Yeah. Yeah. So did everybody hear that? Yes, pretty much. Yeah. All the way back there. Did you hear it? I will repeat it. So this young woman takes a regular lunch break now. She's ritualized taking a regular lunch break. And what she finds is that not only does it allow her to come back to work more refreshed, but even during the time that we might call it downtime, she's finding that she has insights and ideas that actually solve problems that in her everyday work she wasn't able to solve. And that's because of the movement that actually is occurring between the left hemisphere, which is where you are located, most of you, in dominant. It's the left hemisphere is dominant when you're doing analytic, step-by-step, rational, logical work in the course of your day. And then as you go off to lunch, what happens is your right hemisphere begins to come into play, the daydreamy, more visual side. And naturally, ideas and insights rise up. I mean, how many of you would say that you have your best ideas at your desks? Nobody. That's not where we have our best ideas, and that's fair. So she's getting double bang for her buck. She's getting both the renewal that allows her to come back and be more focused in the afternoon, but also the insights. Okay, so in the face of so many demands where expending energy is required of us, what we do is we tend to juggle those demands, don't we? So how many of you, for example, have checked your email while you've been here? You don't even have to raise your hands. I don't want to know because it's depressing. But answer for yourself. How many of you checked email? How many of you have Googled something? How many of you have updated your status on Facebook? How many, you know, there are a whole series of things that you're doing while listening to me that not everybody is, but some people are. Because you're, again, saying to yourself, hey, I can get more things done. I can do more than just one thing. That's what I'm capable of. But you know what? Here's what happens as a result. This was something that Herbert Simon, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics, figured out back in 1978, and that is what information consumes, and that's what we put ourselves in the face of, what information consumes is rather obvious. It consumes the attention of its recipients. Hence, a wealth of information creates a poverty of attention. And the poverty of attention is the energy expenditure problem right now. It's not actually a poverty of attention precisely. It's a split attention that means that you have a poverty of depth and understanding about any given thing that you split your attention between. So if you put all of your attention on one thing, then all of those resources are devoted to that and you get the depth from that. If you split your attention between 11 things, then you get 1/11th of your attention applied to each of the 11 things. And that has a cost. And the cost is to depth, the cost is to quality. There are all kinds of costs, and yet we have taken this for granted. We have assumed that this is the way. This is another change that's occurred that we haven't yet mastered. We've assumed this is the way to manage a very difficult world. You know, an average person, and Google it maybe even higher, answers email 57 times a day, checks email 57 times a day. That's 57 times that you're taking your attention from the locus that it has to something else. So what's the cost? Well, we know that in a car, when you split your attention between talking on the phone and driving the car, which, by the way, ought to be a reasonably easy multitask by any normal, because it's not two cognitive pieces. You can get home without ever thinking about how to get home, can't you? You know that's all built into your system, so you don't even need to use your prefrontal cortex to help it happen, and yet you're four times as likely to have an accident if you're talking on the phone and you are driving at the same time. Which doesn't stop you, does it? How many people here never talk on the phone while driving? So that number, which is about 12 out of 80 people, is 12 more than it probably was a year ago. And what we know is that if you're texting while you're driving, you are 23 times more likely to have an accident. I mean, that's insane. Four times is the equivalent of being legally intoxicated. 23 times is the equivalent of being dead while driving. And that's hard. So this is crazy. This is a performance consequence. You don't think it's an equivalent consequence in your everyday work? Of course it is. Here are the key symptoms of hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Often has difficulty sustaining attention on tasks, doesn't listen when spoken to directly, has difficulty organizing tasks and activities, often avoids, dislikes, or is reluctant to engage in tasks that require sustained mental effort, and is often easily distracted by external stimuli. Does that describe you? Do you have three or four of those that describe you? And if your answer is no, there's somebody who has five, if your answer is no, ask the person who knows you best whether you're lying. Right? This is who we are. They don't even have a diagnosis for it. This is normal. This is how the world exists. But you look at those and you say, that's crazy. That makes no sense. What's the longest? Ask yourself this question. What's the longest you've gone without checking email during the past month? When was the last time that you intentionally took an hour or two out of your day to think creatively or long-term without interruption? And how often do you sit back for a few moments, take a deep breath, and quiet your mind? Here, let's do it. Put your feet on the floor. Put your feet on the floor. This is a special favor. It's an extra thing that you weren't even expected to get. This is free. This is free. And by the way, you will never have a moment where your supervisor comes up to you and says to you, what are you doing? I'm noticing you're breathing. You're not allowed to do that. Why aren't you working? No. This is one you can get away with any time. This is an example of the power of recovery to occur in an incredibly short time. I want you to breathe in through your nose to a count of three and out through your mouth to a count of six. I want you to do it with your eyes closed for a little while, and I'll bring you back to the room. In through your nose to a count of three, out through your mouth to a count of six. Let's do it. Okay, you can come back to the room. 30 seconds. Anybody feel any difference doing that? Is that how you normally breathe? 30 seconds is enough to shift your physiology quite dramatically. If we hooked you up to monitors, those of you who did that effectively, I And I'll say what I mean by that in just a sec. Those of you who did it effectively would have had a visible movement from sympathetic arousal, that's the fight or flight system, to parasympathetic arousal, just 30 seconds. And by the way, the better you get at it, the more you train that recovery, the more effectively you do recover in that period of time. So the lesson of this, I'm going to say, is how many of you had a thought or two, or 10, or 30, during those 30 seconds? How many had that? You may not even have noticed, but a good number of you. The point is that your mind does have a mind of its own, and that we need to find a way, having looked at those ADHD symptoms, we need to find a way, if we want to spend energy more skillfully, to recollect our attention. We've lost control of our attention. That's the critical problem from an energy expenditure point of view. If your attention is going to whatever is around you, you don't own your attention. I'm going to skip that one. This is the conclusion that David Meyer, the leading researcher on multitasking, came to about the way we currently operate, doing multiple things at a time. That you can get some strategies that improve your ability to handle multiple tasks at the same time, but you can train till you're blue in the face, and you'll never be as good as if you just focused on one thing at a time, period, full stop. How often do you focus on one thing at a time? This is what we've lost. We've lost flow, which is the Csikszentmihalyi term, for what happens when you truly, truly collect your attention. It's the state in which you're so involved in an activity that nothing else seems to matter, you lose track of time, and your retention, your depth, your absorption are at the highest possible level. This is what Wynne Gallagher had to say, that the skillful management of attention is the sine qua non of the good life, and it's the key to improving virtually everything. I want to give you one last piece before I finish here about the defining difference that I think we need to take hold of if we're going to really shift the paradigm from reactive mode in the face of intense demand, from continuous work to a intentional rhythm that you build back into your life. When it all comes down to it, the bottom line has to do with your ability to delay gratification. So what do I mean by that? Well, I want to revisit just for a second this famous study, this famous marshmallow study, and for some reason, some of you probably know it, it's whose study? Does anybody know? It'll come back into my mind. But this is a very famous study done back originally in the 1960s, and this is what he did. He took four-year-olds. He brought them into a room. He said to them, if you want to eat this marshmallow, there's a marshmallow right here, if you'd like to eat it, I'm going to leave the room, ring the bell, and I'll come back, and you can eat it. However, if you can wait until I come back without ringing the bell, you can have two marshmallows. Having decided that marshmallows were particularly appealing to four-year-old kids, goes out of the room, 70% of them ring the bell within under 3 minutes. They come back, they have their marshmallow. 30% of them are able to delay for the full 15 minutes it takes him to come back into the room. So this is interesting, but what's really interesting is what happens years later when he goes back and looks at these kids and compares 15, 20 years later, because this was done in the 1960s, 15 to 20, what are the difference in the outcomes in their lives? And the ones, the long delayers, the ones who could stay the course, end up being more confident, resilient, self-reliant, trusting, dependable, and persevering, and they score 120 points higher on their SATs on average than the low delayers. They have way more lasting friendships, and they're far more resilient in the face of stress. What does this tell us? It's about attention. It's about attention. What is it that the great delayers do that the non-delayers don't? They control their attention instinctively. The great delayers, what they're able to do is they move their attention from the object of desire to something else to purposely distract themselves. they instinctively figure out that if they put themselves in harm's way, if they put themselves in sight of that marshmallow, they will eat that marshmallow as sure as anything will happen. The same is true for that ping of your email. The same is true for that text that comes in. The same is true for when you take an activity that feels urgent and you do that instead of doing something that is more challenging to do because it's more challenging to do, because you don't want to delay gratification. Email is candy. Email is alcohol. Email is cocaine. All of these are playing that role. And we are giving in to them because we're being run by our reptilian brain. We are not bringing intentionality to it. We're not building behaviors that allow us to do what those kids did. Now, he goes back, Walter Mischel is his name. Walter Mischel goes back and tries to understand what was the reason that the low delayers, the high delayers, were able to do it. And he finds an incredibly close correlation between how secure they felt with their mothers versus the other kids who felt more insecure. It has all to do with the early attachment to their mothers and how well that was worked through. Well, guess what? That's no longer available to us. Whatever happened, happened, right? So we can't play that game. If we had bad mothers, we're going to have to deal with it, right? So what did he do? He did something ingenious. What he did was he watched what the successful ones did and he taught the unsuccessful ones to do the same thing. So he took the kids who couldn't delay, and this is more recent, and he taught them to move their attention to something else. In minutes, he got them to the point where they could wait 15 minutes for that marshmallow. Why? Because he took on intentional training of attention. That's what we need to do. We need to train our own attention just like it's a muscle. Push past your comfort zone and recover. Try working for 60 minutes without reading email and then recover. And recovery, by the way, isn't reading email. Recovery is shifting out of cognitive mode even for a short time. So what are the keys to great performance? How do we understand everything I've said to you today? This is what it is. This is the best study ever done. Anybody here read Outliers? So Malcolm Gladwell talks about this Anders Ericsson study in his book, and he gets it half right. The only half he misses is the important part. The half he gets right, oh gosh, and this is going to be on YouTube. he gets what he gets right. How about that? What he gets is that the great performers work harder than everybody else. That's true. And the 10,000-hour rule, it takes 10,000 hours to be expert and all of that. But there's so much more interesting stuff from this study. So here's what it is. Three groups of violinists, 10 in each group. They ask the teachers who to divide them from, the ones who are going to become soloists, the ones who are going to become members of orchestras, the ones who are going to become teachers. Those are the least skilled. Then he asks them to fill out a sheet every hour for 168 hours. How important was this activity you did during the last hour to improving as a violinist? How difficult was it? How enjoyable was it? And they do it for 168 hours. This is what they find out. Practice is indeed the most important thing you can do to improve as a violinist and to improve in anything. The top violinists practice 24 hours a week. The less good violinists practice 9 hours a week. Huge difference. Big deal. Is that a surprise? That doesn't tell you anything. Here's what's interesting about it. Practice, first of all, is what they say is not only most important, but it's the most difficult thing they do and the least enjoyable thing they do. That's interesting. To be good at something, you need to suffer. You need to go to your discomfort. But this is what's really interesting. The top groups practice in a particular way. 3 sessions a day, 1.5 hours or less, 90 minutes or less, ultradian rhythm or less, and then a renewal break. The bottom group practices in the afternoon, having procrastinated. The top group practices in the morning. Now, the most interesting thing of all in this study is, what's the second most important thing to improving as a violinist? Beside practice. It's sleep. The top group sleep an average of 8.5 hours a night. And the second group. The bottom group sleeps 7.5 hours a night. At bottom group is, that's a mess, that's wrong on that slide. And so it should be 8.5, 7.5, and most of us sleep 6.5 hours. So that means we sleep 14 hours a night less than great performers do. Is that crazy? They sleep 14 hours more than we do. Now, this is what I think is the conclusion of everything I've said. It is not about staying the course. It is not about pushing yourself for long periods of time. I wrote my new book, in 3 90-minute sprints with a break in between each one. The key to your great performance is intense effort balanced by deep recovery. It's becoming a sprinter inside a marathon. You live in a marathon, but the way to thrive in that marathon is to push yourself to the limit and then recover. Push yourself to the limit and then recover. When you're working, really work. When you're renewing, really renewing. Stop living in the gray zone in between. Stop living there. Build back boundaries and finish lines into your life, because that's what will make your lives great. Thank you very much.